Welcome into another edition of the Flagrant 2 podcast with Bill Ryder and Forgrave. Travis Schlenk, the GM of the Atlanta Hawks, going to join me in person at this beautiful hotel here in New York in just about 3 minutes. He's walking in here in a second. Reed is not here today in large part because Reed is at the Minneapolis Best City in America Festival and hanging out and doing his thing there. But Joey Levin is here. Joey, did you have a date last night?
No, I took it easy because we had Travis Schlenk. I didn't want to.
You didn't get on the old Unhinged app?
No.
Swipe right.
No, I mean, ever since she canceled on me, I just haven't been back on.
There's been a sadness to Joey for a long time. By the way, remember Lance Stevenson, who was, I'm doing off the top of my head, but I think a pretty impressive, like, 4 of 17 or 5 of 16 the other night, needs to be the Eastern Conference All-Star captain. Get your votes ready. Operation hashtag Born Ready All-Stars. Is that what it is?
Yeah, that's it.
This is actually a Joey Levin creation. You need to get on that. So Travis Schlenk, and you and I were just talking about this off-air, Joey, came up in the video room for the Miami Heat. Yep. And sort of worked his way up through the NBA, was the top assistant of the Golden State Warriors, was the guy who scouted Draymond Green, I would imagine. We'll ask him, like, was the voice in the room on draft night in that second round saying, take him. And I've talked about this on the podcast, my history, my background, sort of my day-to-day at least start in covering the league was covering the Miami Heat. And I was, because of the podcast, you know, I can be kind of mean sometimes. You know, Reed's a nice guy, I'm the mean guy. I was hard on LeBron that first year. I was hard on a lot of people on that team. I have a good relationship with the Heat now, but I didn't then. One guy that I got along with was Eric Spoelstra, for whatever reason. And so I spent most of my time talking to him because in any situation, if only one person in a room will talk to you, that's who you visit with. And I always – he was very fascinating and thoughtful, Spoelstra, on his time in the video room. That's a job you had.
Yep.
As well, like – the grind of it, what you learn, the expectations, and obviously, and I'm not taking shots at any other coach in the NBA, Cliff included, but to do that under Pat Riley is I've been told, a whole other level of fear, intensity, work ethic, focus, discipline, and if you're good enough, sort of learning. So I'll be really curious to hear from Travis just how much that did or didn't contribute to where he's gotten today.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it on the pod a couple times. I worked in the video room in Charlotte for 5 years. My last 2 years were with Steve Clifford, but all 5 of those years I was with Steven Silas, who's now the associate head coach there. I've heard Travis's name from Steven a few times.
Back in the day.
Back in the day when he was assistant GM for the Warriors. Yep. And executive in the front office. And I had just – and also Drew Perry, who's the advanced scout in Charlotte now, I'd heard his name from Drew as well, just as a guy like – this guy's going to be a GM.
A reputation guy. Good guy.
I didn't know.
I don't know him well, but when he got the job, people that I know around the league, sort of to your point, were like, oh, it's going to be a process, but he's going to probably do it.
Yeah. I mean, I remember hearing his name. Like, even when I was looking for jobs, like a guy like Steven or a guy like Drew would be like, oh, maybe I can reach out to Travis. Great guy. Like, really great guy. Knows his stuff. He's going to be a – like, when he becomes a GM, maybe he's a guy.
And we're going to try to keep this for all of you listening, not just Hawks fans. Though Hawks fans, obviously, you'll be very interested. We're going to have sort of an – I'm just curious about, like, the path to a GM and what you learn and where you come from and who teaches you. And I'm going to ask him because, like, it doesn't matter what you do for a living. Like, everybody gets – well, you get unlucky breaks. You work for me. But those of us that things are going well, Joey – I've had breaks in my life that are like, I once had a wedding at a drink I had with a guy, like, changed my life because I had a job interview the next day. And he's like, now come work for me, right?
Yep.
Those things happen. So we'll talk to Travis about sort of his path and what he's learned and his plans, and absolutely going to get into tanking and all kinds of good stuff. By the way, before we do that, he's about to walk in. Remember that buying tickets to sports and concerts can be complicated, but there is a better, simpler way to buy with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just 2 taps. SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team or musician. For Reed Forgrave, that would be, you know, a country musician in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. We all have the SeatGeek app. It's really good. It's really easy. It's really intuitive. And best of all, our listeners, that's you listening, get $20 off. That's $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app like we have and enter the promo code I. That's EYE as in UCEYE. That's promo code EYE for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Okay, let's get Travis Schlenk and have a nice conversation. All right, as promised, we're hanging out with the general manager of the Atlanta Hawks, Travis Schlenk. Thanks for making time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So, congratulations on the gig, of course. Let's just start with sort of why this was the right opportunity and sort of what your plans are.
Well, as you know, I probably had the best job in the NBA the last few years working for the Warriors. You just sit back there and watch Steph and Clay and KD make a bunch of shots and walk out of the gyms happy. But when this opportunity came and I met with the ownership group, I immediately could see their passion and their desire that they wanted to have the Atlanta Hawks be one of the top teams in the NBA. And when you get into professional sports, having ownership that's invested and willing to invest financially and emotionally into their team and the community, that's when I knew that if I could get this job, it would be a great opportunity.
Obviously, Golden State, as you said, you guys, you were an assistant GM there. You were one of the guys that scouted, and I think have scouted Draymond Green. You guys have had a little bit of success. You know, things have gone okay in Golden State. What is it? Did you think much, just in a like workflow sense or just a strategic sense? How do I try to replicate the culture and the approach here and bring it somewhere completely distinct?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of that was already set here in Atlanta. I mean, they have a good culture here. You know, for 10 years in a row, they'd been in the playoffs. You know, the coaching staff here has a proven track record of developing young players. So I was very fortunate in that sense to come into this situation and not have to worry about going to hire a good coach. We have a good coach. We have a good coaching staff. So that was already in place, and that was a huge bonus for me. They already had several assets lined up. When we talk about assets, draft picks lined up in the future, now we're able to add a couple more this offseason with the approach we took. But when it comes to the draft, I mean, there's a little luck involved, obviously. And my theory is, you know, the more swings of the bat you have, the more chances you have to get a hit. So, you know, we'll more than likely have 3 first-round draft picks this year. So if we can get, you know, hit on 2 of them, that would be great. Obviously, last year we feel like we got lucky with John Collins, slept him to the 19th spot for us. So, you know, we're going to try to build this thing organically with, you know, we have a group of young guys we like, and we're just going to keep adding young pieces to it.
So I'm curious, just philosophically, there are a lot of general managers you'll bump into on the road. They'll be scouting their own players. They'll be on some crummy overnight, not taking a shot at Southwest, but some Southwest flight. Every flight is crummy at 5 in the morning. And some GMs or presidents of operations don't scout as much and sort of send their folks out to do it for them and collate all the information. Do you have a strong sort of philosophy, one way or the other, on how much you personally, Travis Schlenk, want to see the guys who, when it's draft night, you are making the decisions?
Yeah, no, I'll be out there. I'll see guys. That's how I came up. Theoretically, that's what I'm supposed to be good at. So I'll be out there seeing it. Now, also that being said, I also have a staff, you know, because one person can't be anywhere. It's also very important for me to be around our team, you know, as a young team with young pieces, because like you said, I need to figure out who's long term for the Atlanta Hawks and, you know, who's short term. So seeing the guys interact, chemistry such a big thing with me, character such a big thing with me, getting to know these guys on a personal level. But on off days, days like this, once the college season gets kicked up, I won't be hanging out with the team. I'll be at a college game somewhere, like I mentioned, because we do have the 3 first-round draft picks. So it'll be a busy couple of years for me, but that's the gig we signed up for.
We talk about back-to-backs, but when you're a scout or a GM, it's sometimes back-to-back-to-back-to-back-to-back, right? I don't experience it, but I've talked to guys about it. That's a grind.
Yeah, being a scout, there's been several articles. You know, everyone thinks it's a pretty glamorous lifestyle, but like you said, there's the 5 a.m. wake up calls to drop the rental car off, to go get on your coach seat, to go to your next Courtyard Marriott, and then to go watch your next game. And then it's just repetitive day after day after day. I describe it as a very nomadic lifestyle.
I'll out one GM because I like him. He's a good guy, and it worked. But I remember being on the road. I used to travel 25, 26 days a month when I was a full-time sports writer. And one, like, miserable seven-month stretch, and I lived in Kansas City, it was winter, I bumped into Neil O'Shea, who's the GM in Portland. It must have been 7 or 8 nights in a month at, you know, college towns, nice places, but again, not at 6 in the morning when it's snowing and sleeting. And obviously, like, he's done a pretty nice job drafting, and it's not like he's had the first or second pick. And that's a big part of success today. You guys in Golden State thrived at bringing in guys, and Draymond Green's the example people always go to, second-round pick. You scouted Draymond.
Yeah, no, I watched Draymond for 3 years at Michigan State. You know, obviously he played for four, but when I came into the front office, you know, he was already a sophomore. Klay Thompson at the 11th pick. You know, Steph was the 7th pick. Harrison Barnes was the 7th pick. Festus Ezeli, you know, was the 30th pick. So there's guys every year that slip into the draft. I mean, look, last year, you know, Malcolm Brogdon, rookie of the year, was a second-round draft pick. So you don't have to have the first, second, third pick in the draft. You know, there's obviously, like I said, luck goes in there. You need guys to slip to you sometimes, but you have to make the right decision when those guys slip to you as well.
So take us into like into a draft room, into the preparation beforehand, whether it's a Draymond Green, whether it's somebody else. And you're the primary scout, you're the primary eyes on a player. How much selling goes on when you're sort of pitching up to whoever's making the decision?
You know, it's interesting. So I've been in the league for 20 years now, and I've seen two different styles, right? There's the one style of guy that waits for the decision maker, whether it's a head coach or a GM, and whenever they say, I like this person, there's the type of scout that, yep, he's the guy, you know?
You're and, right, boss.
You know, and I assume that's good for job security. That's not what I like, or that's not how I am. I'm the type of person that will give you my thoughts, and if they disagree with yours, I will disagree with you respectfully if you're the senior in the room. But I prefer people to give me their honest opinion, and you know, working this year in Atlanta, getting the job a month before the draft and having a brand new staff, you know, we kept everybody there because, as I mentioned, they'd been successful, and I didn't honestly want the headache of trying to build a new staff, you know, 3 weeks before the draft. It was really good because those folks there, they gave me their honest opinion, and there was disagreement in the room. And to me, that's healthy. You know, we have a staff. There's a reason why these people have their jobs. So you have to give them a chance to do their job and express themselves.
There's always, and not just in basketball, it's true in my profession, it's true in my wife's, it's true in every profession, when a new boss comes in and there's an old team in place, people get worried about the new regime, what's going to happen. Did anyone call you or pull you aside and give you some advice and say, hey, Travis, here's when you go into the situation in Atlanta, here's how you just manage or make people comfortable or make them feel empowered and create some trust quickly, especially given your timeline on the draft wasn't 7 months, it was 3 weeks.
Yeah, it's interesting. So when you get one of these jobs, or probably any job when you're in the position to hire people, you get roughly 1,000 text messages the first hour. you have more friends than you ever knew you had.
What's up?
So I remember I was flying from L.A. to Atlanta when the news broke. And when I landed, you know, I had all these messages, voicemails, text messages, and I told my wife how many I had, and she just started laughing. She goes, you don't have that many friends, which is true. But no, there are two pieces of advice I got. One of them I agreed with, one of them I didn't. There's the one school of thought that we talked about. You have to bring your own people in. You have to have people there you can trust. And then the approach that I went with was, well, these guys have been successful in the past. They've done a good job. They've done all the work. Let's work with them. So what I did day one when I got there is I set everyone down. I said, listen, go about your job the way you normally do. I don't have time to come in here and tell you how to do your job day one. We've got to get this done in 3 weeks. And I said, as I see things, and if I want to tweak it, I'll just let you know. But you guys just go do what you normally do because you've done a good job here.
Was it what was the sensation like being the boss? You know, you talked about your philosophy was you're going to give the boss in the rooms you sat in as you worked your way up your honest opinion, even if they saw it differently, respectfully. Now you are the boss. What was it like trying that on and just getting adjusted to that? Because I've never been a boss, thank God for everyone that's ever worked around me, but my wife has, and it was in a different profession, and it was a big adjustment for her.
So the hardest part for me is I'm terrible with names.
Like, oh, I'm too.
I've already forgotten your name.
Steve, no, Bill.
I'm just joking. I haven't forgotten your name. But.
No, that's why I get to walk around with a notebook as a reporter. I get to write, like, literally write everyone's like, hey, what's going on?
So, so we had a very small staff in Golden State when you look at the size of NBA front offices. And not that the staff is huge in Atlanta compared to some, but it was a lot bigger than I was used to. So it was just walking in the room and having six, seven people looking at me and not knowing everybody's name. Like, that it's important
it's
to
hard.
Know yeah it's important to know people's names, yeah. But you know, you meet every time I turn a corner when I first got the job, but there'd be a person I recognized, but I couldn't remember their name, so that was a little frustrating.
It's not the same thing. When I got into TV, everyone knew your name because you're on TV, and there'd be 80 people at this lot, and somebody gave me advice. I used to have a file on my phone and notes, and like, you know, Joey has a beard. It'd be like, bearded guy dressed like a hipster, Joey. And I would literally, like, a guy, like, Joey would stop me, and I would open my phone, like, hey, just start, let me just, and I would look at, like, bearded guy looks like a hipster, and be like, hey, Joey, I'm good. It's hard. It's a process.
I wish I had a story like that, but I don't.
Well, the problem with that is when you go, hey, Steve, and it's like, yeah, my name's Joey. It's got the wrong description. It happens. So my first full-time covering an NBA team day-to-day was the Miami Heat, LeBron's first year with the Big Three, and I got to know Eric Spoelstra, really liked Eric, and he used to talk a lot about how important and how rigorous coming up in the video room under Pat Riley was, the hours, the education, the attention to detail. That is a job that you had many years ago. How significant was that in sort of your development and your growth early on, and obviously an NBA career that has led to being a general manager?
Yeah, so I like to tell people I got my undergraduate degree at Bethel College. I got my master's degree at Wichita State, and then I got my doctorates in basketball working for the Miami Heat. So when I got there, you know, Pat was the head coach. Stan Van Gundy was the first assistant coach. Jeff Bezdelic was on the coaching staff. Mark Arvoroni was on the coaching staff. Obviously, Eric was on the coaching staff. So I was there around all these guys who have all these knowledge that went on. All of them went on to be head coaches in the NBA. And just the level of attention to detail Pat has, it's off the charts. So when you're the video guy and you're the guy putting the clips together that Pat's going to show the team or helping put the scouting reports together, I mean, driving to the airport at 4 in the morning to put the tapes and the scouting report in Pat's car so, you know, he can get home and watch them the next day. It taught me not only basketball, but it also taught me a work ethic. You and I spoke earlier, you know, we're both kind of from middle America, small towns, and, you know, where I grew up, you know, people were farmers and, you know, you work 7 days a week.
My family were farmers, yep.
Yeah, you, you know, you go feed the livestock before you have your own breakfast. So I felt like I had a real work ethic, but when, you know, you work for Pat, it was just at another level. And the environment he created, it was, you know, it's almost as if everyone was fighting for Pat's affection. So you just wanted to keep doing as best you could, just trying to keep up.
Did he give it out much, or did he dole it out in very small doses? Because I've worked for people where you crave their approval because they've earned that desire because of who they are and how they work.
He would, but excuse me, he would, but it was what's the right word? You had to. It wasn't a daily thing.
He wasn't Santa Claus with it.
Yeah.
So what were those hours like? What was like a typical hour as the video? I mean, a video guy in any NBA team is a that's a lot of hours.
Yeah.
I would imagine more in that situation.
Yeah, it was really early mornings, you know, 5:30, 6 a.m. mornings. And then, you know, on a game night, you'd be there till, you know, 1, 2 in the morning. You know, obviously during the off season, it wasn't that crazy. But during the season, that's what it was. Stan was a very early riser, so you had to get there early to be able to assist with anything you might want.
Damn you, Stan. So that very quickly, because we talked about this too before we started the interview, and Joey's talked about this, and I've been around it. It sounds like it's a real glamorous life to be a head coach or a GM or a scout on an NBA team, but it really is like airport, arena, hotel, video room, airport, arena. So you learn very early on it's not, you know, it's work, and it's a grind.
Well, certainly better than having a real job. Let's be clear there.
It's true. No, it's better than selling insurance or being a farmer. And I have relatives who do both.
Yeah.
It's interesting because every career needs sort of big breaks and great mentors, right? And people who treated you well and taught you through their example. If you look back, what were your two or three big breaks? And you know, who are the people, one or two or three or however many, who sort of taught you the things it turned out you needed to know to be sitting here today as the general manager of an NBA team?
Well, the first thing that a lot of it for me anyway was just dumb luck. You know, I'm a kid from Western Kansas, a town of 200 people. So the first real big break I had was getting an internship with the Orlando Magic. When I was in grad school, I had to do an internship somewhere, and I really didn't know what to do it in, so I just sent it out to all the NBA teams, and I was fortunate enough to be offered three positions, one with the Wizards, one with the Heat, actually, and one with Orlando, and the one in Orlando was working in the basketball operations department. So I got an internship, and at the time Orlando had a reputation, and unbeknownst to me, it's not like I knew this. I just was dumb luck.
Yeah, from Kansas.
Exactly. But they were had an internship program in the video room. Tom Sterner was kind of in charge of that, and he was a big name in the NBA at the time on the video side of things. So Chuck Daly had just been named the head coach. Brandon Sir was assistant. Tom was an assistant. Eric Musselman was on the staff. Tree Rollins was on the staff.
Wow.
So there I was, just a dumb kid in the right place. And the real big break with that, if that wasn't a big enough break, was the fact the league meetings that year were in Orlando. For the first time in years, they were always in Chicago, but they had them out at Disney. That's when, you know, Disney and ESPN and NBA were starting to get together. So as an intern, I was able to go to the league meetings. And, you know, I remember meeting with first time I met Eric Spoelstra.
Really?
Is at that.
How old
were
you? It's like 21, 22?
That would have been 1997, so I would have been 24.
Wow.
Now people that are good at math can figure out how old I am.
Luckily I'm not. I can't add. Subtract.
But, you know, not only Eric, Frank Vogel was there. So all these young guys, that I think even Coach Bud might have been there. All these young guys at the time were video coordinators. Who, you know, obviously got on to great careers, you know, meeting all those folks for the first time. So that was the first big break, I would say, is, you know, just being in the right place at the right time and just being lucky. You know, the second big break is obviously getting the job working for Pat in Miami, because, you know, any time that you...
How did that happen?
Excuse me. So I had met Eric the year before. As I mentioned, Orlando had a good video program. Jeff Bezdelic had been the advanced scout for the Miami Heat. He wanted to come off the road to be closer to his family, closer to his kids. So they moved him to being in the office full time, writing all the scouting reports. And Eric was going to go from video coordinator to advanced scout. So they needed to hire a video guy. You know, Eric had known me from the year before, and I went down and interviewed and got the job. So again, it was all because of that first meeting. So then, you know, getting the job with Miami, anytime anyone works for Pat, you immediately have credibility around the league. So that was the next big break, is actually getting a full-time job there. The last big break, I would say, came, well, two of them, in Golden State. Don Nelson came to me and he said, I think you have a great eye for talent. I think you should go to the front office. And there was a structural change, organizational change happening at that time. Chris Mullin had been the general manager, but then Larry Riley became the general manager. So Larry asked me to come with him to the front office, and it was just he and I. So I like to tell everyone, I felt like I knew basketball, but when I got that job, all of a sudden I had to learn the business of basketball, because, you know, when you work in the NBA, or, you know, as you've worked around the NBA, you feel like you have an understanding of the salary cap and all that stuff. Now it was up to me to write contracts, you know, keep track of all the details of the day-to-day stuff. So I was a fish out of water, man.
That was the transition, as Coach Nelson sort of said, I think this is a path for you that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. He told me, and at first, you know, my whole desire coming up was to be a coach. And so then you have, you know, your boss tell you, your Hall of Fame boss tell you, you know what, you should take a different path. And, you know, you're a little taken back. But he did say one thing at the end of the conversation. He said, you know, I've told this to a few people in the past, and only one person's listened to me, and that was Donnie, referring to his son, Donnie Nelson, who's obviously had a great career with the Mavericks. So at the time, we had just had our first daughter, and I took a step back and said, you know what, when you look historically in the NBA, there's a lot more security in the front offices than there is in the coaching ranks. So I went with it, and obviously I'm sitting here with you now, so it's worked out for
Your wife is probably happy by that story, too. I have a wife with a daughter, and she liked it when I got off the road, too.
Well, no, my wife actually wasn't happy at all at the
really?
First. Well, as we touched on, I don't know if it was on the air before when we were talking earlier, so it went from, as an assistant coach, the schedule comes out, my wife knows exactly when I'm going to be gone, I'm going to be. But as a scout, she has no idea where I am or when I'll be back or what day I'm leaving, stuff. So, you know, it was an adjustment for her, because the front office side's a lot more year-round job than the coaching side. The coaching side, you know, once the season's over with, you still might have guys you're working out in the office, but you can kind of have some downtime on the front office side. The season's over, you go right into the draft. And once the draft's over, you go right into free agency. And then, you know, August and September are kind of slow months for us.
The story's really interesting, because I know several guys who started out at a low level video room, wherever it might be, and their goal was coaching, and they had maybe not that direct of the advice to Veer, but they had the chance to Veer, and they were very, you know, set, no, I want to coach. What is it about, you think, talented people in the NBA where it's coaching that attracts them and not having the power and the ability to shape a team? At, you know, you have more influence in that role.
Listen, we're all in this because we're competitive people, right? And when you're on the sidelines, you know, in the heat of the battle, the, you know, the camaraderie of being on the team, you know, I go to a game, I'm sitting in the stands, I have no control of what's going to happen. You know, it's kind of a helpless feeling. I've come to terms with it, but even as a back row assistant coach all those years, you know, if you see a play coming or hear a play call, you know, you might be able to yell at a guy, hey, they're coming at you, whatever. So you feel like you have an impact on winning and losing. So I think that's the reason why.
That's interesting. There's a power that you have to sort of let go, you know, that grip a little bit.
For no question.
What does Spoelstra always say? Like, don't let go of the rope or whatever? It's like letting go of the rope in a macro sense. So for you, some of your decisions, a lot of changes since you came in. You traded Dwight Howard. Paul Millsap obviously is in Denver. You let Tim Hardaway walk as well. What was behind the decision? I mean, to a lot of people, myself included, it sounds like a rebuild. Like, okay, this hasn't worked at the level we want. Let's sort of start it, not ground zero, but closer, and let's rebuild something in Travis Schlenk's image, in his philosophy. Is that a fair description?
Well, we don't like to use that term. To me, that sounds like you're conceding to losing, and we're not conceding to losing. You know, we have a young core of players that, you know, we spoke about, Dennis, DeAndre Bembry, who just got hurt, Torian Prince, and, you know, we added John Collins that year. So we feel like we have, you know, that's the foundation for our future. So the decisions you described earlier, they were financial decisions, to be frank. It's real important to have financial flexibility at this time as you're starting the growth of your franchise, or as we like to say, investing in the future of our franchise. So by having that financial flexibility, it allowed us to go out and get a first round draft pick this year. It allowed us to go out and acquire a couple second round draft picks in another deal we did by taking on teams' contracts. So as we mentioned earlier, the more chances you have to draft or pick players in the draft, the more chances you have to get draft picks right. So we're trying to acquire as many picks as we can, keep building it with the young guys we have, keep growing the young guys we have already, and this is the foundation of all that.
You know, Dwight Howard, there was a report out that when he was traded that your players cheered. It's not a secret that there's a perspective out there, fair otherwise, that Dwight is not always the best chemistry builder. You referenced earlier in the conversation that you want guys that build chemistry. Was that part of the decision to move Dwight, that maybe he wasn't the right person for whatever it is, your culture you're trying to create in Atlanta?
I mean, to be fair, I wasn't there last year, so I can't really speak to that. I don't know Dwight as a person, and when I got the job, I exchanged a few text messages with him. It was really just trying to, you know, we were going to reset a little bit, obviously, and build with our younger guys. So, you know, we kind of made the decision that we need to let those young guys get out there and play more. Anytime you have a strong veteran presence, you know, it makes it harder for the young guys to get out there and put themselves out there. So we wanted to kind of clear the path for our young guys a little bit.
You know, and on that same culture conversation, obviously, I mean, Steph Curry, clearly a remarkable basketball player. We all know now, two-time MVP, one-time unanimous MVP, champion, maybe the greatest shooter of all time. I mean, the guy can play basketball. I would imagine, as a culture builder, very significant part of sort of like what was created in Golden State, whether it's him, whether it's Draymond, whether it's Coach Kerr, whether it's you and Jerry West and Bob and the whole group. Any lessons you took from the Warriors that you think you can apply in a vacuum? Just here's how we create a basketball culture among our players. Is it the right point guard? Is it the right player? Is it the right, like, what are some things you can do that maybe other organizations haven't done in the past to jumpstart that process?
I think the biggest thing when you know, obviously you talk about Golden State and talk about Steph, it's extremely important that your best player is a good person. You know, you look at the Spurs for all those years, you know, their best player was Tim Duncan. And Tim Duncan, not only a great basketball player, but a great person, high character. And when you're top player falls in line with, listen guys, this is how we're going to do it, it starts to build from there. So, you know, when you look at us with Steph, It's the same thing. When your best player is that kind of person, it makes it real easy. Or Oklahoma City coming up with Kevin. Kevin's another great person. So those are the things that make it easy.
I believe that. And like, I think a lot of people, I know a lot of people roll their eyes at that because I talk a lot on the radio show. I cover teams. I'm not inside like you are. But I think culture absolutely matters. And a lot of fans kind of roll their eyes.
Yeah, listen, it makes it so much easier. I've been, you know, coaching guys. When you just see them, it's just deflating because they're just miserable to be around every single day. And, you know, from covering teams, these guys spend more time together than they do with their families during the season. So if you have a guy or a couple guys on a team that just bring everybody down, it's a deflating feeling, and it makes it really hard to overcome. And I'm not saying guys have to be best friends, but you have to have, you know, good guys that when you come to work every day, you know, it's exciting to see, and you know you're going to get the best out of them every day.
I'm not sure it's easy, but it's certainly more sort of obvious to scout basketball talent. How do you scout what we're talking about here?
So just one of the things when I go to games, just during timeouts, just watching how guys interact with each other on the bench, or when a player comes out of the game and, you know, do they talk to the coach? If the coach says something to them, the coach tries to stop them, do they like veer around? Do they sit at the end of the bench? Do they sit next to the coach? Just all those little things. And then, you know, you can really see it when you start going to college practices. Seeing how the player practices. Do they go hard all the time? Do they interact with their teammates? Are they the type of guy that makes a pass they think somebody should have caught, and do they yell at them? You know, just little things like that.
I'm not a scout by any stretch, and I've seen that in college practice. It's like, wow, this is really illuminating. Coach, thanks for letting me stand here. Young players listening, that is a NBA general manager telling you these things actually matter. Were you guys, and there were reports, and I had heard that you guys were going to target Kevin Durant, you guys being Golden State when you were there. Was there a level of shock nonetheless when it was like, okay, Kevin Durant is a Golden State Warrior and is joining this ridiculously talented 73-win team?
So I remember very clearly, it was July 4th. It was about 9:30 a.m. Bob calls me. And my family and I were just getting ready to go to breakfast. And he's like, we got him. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, he's coming. He's going to put it out on the Players Tribune in about 20 minutes. He said, we can't tell anybody. And at the time, it was just Joe Lacob, Bob Myers, myself that knew, and then obviously Kevin and whoever was in his group. So I, you know, Bob and I have our moment on the phone. And then I go into my kids who are waiting for me to take them to breakfast. And I said, listen, I've got some bad news for you. Steph Curry might not be the best player on the Warriors anymore. And my oldest daughter started to cry. Like, I said, no, no, it's all right.
You're such a jerk.
It's all right. He's still here. So, yeah, it was it's a moment that I hope that we can replicate here in Atlanta for sure.
All right, so I'm not asking you to have sympathy for the other teams who can't keep up with what you guys created in Golden State. But do you think, I mean, Michael Jordan doesn't like the fact that there's no parity or whatever the right term is. Is there a team, honestly, a team that can beat the Warriors in a seven-game series this year, assuming that sort of health remains as it is right now?
Well, that's obviously the great equalizer, right? Or maybe the biggest factor. Because when you look, you know, in 2015, we won the championship. You know, Cleveland loses Kyrie in game one. Lost Kevin earlier in the playoffs, Kevin Love. The following year, you know, Steph was not 100% with his knee. You know, we're not using that as an excuse, or no one was.
But I was there. You could tell.
He wasn't the same guy. You know, and then we lost, Cleveland won. So, you know, health is so important. You look at what happened with the Clippers all those years. You know, they were good teams, and they always, you know, last year was both Chris and Blake that went out. So health is a huge factor. Kawhi last year, you know, the Spurs had 20-point leads on us every single game last year, and Kawhi gets hurt in game one, and they're up 20.
Yeah, they were.
So are they beatable? Sure. Is a team going to have to play great four times? Yeah, because they're a machine.
I won't make you name them, but how many teams are there that could actually reasonably do that? If everything goes well, three in the NBA?
Yeah. Four? I mean, listen, they're good. They are.
You did a good job. You did too good a job.
Yeah.
A lot of people would argue. What's up with the – is it just part of the game, a rash of injuries? I mean, obviously the Gordon Hayward thing is so ugly, but you have Jeremy Lin. I mean, I could sort of go down the list. A lot of guys getting hurt. Is it just early on bad luck?
I would assume so. You know, guys nowadays do such a great job of keeping themselves in shape year round. You know, you see, talk about Gordon's injury, just such a freak injury, but we've seen it now, you know, off the top of my head, three times. And so you just wonder if guys are becoming so strong and the force is so great, you know, just the bone just snapped. You know, I think Paul George is a little bit different because he had the backboard, but, you know, same sort of injury. Yeah. The kid, and his name escapes me, in the Final Four from Louisville, same kind of injury.
Where? Kevin,
yeah,
Ware?
Yeah, it's just, you're right. Just, you know, when you go back 10 years ago, you never saw injuries like that. But these guys are so well-conditioned and so powerful and maximizing everything they have. You just wonder if, you know, they're pushing their bodies to the limit.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously super unfortunate. I really enjoyed the conversation. One last question and let you run. Before, you were at such a dominant place that any sort of adjustments to the idea of tanking or how the draft, or sort of the top picks in the draft are allotted, really was not significant to the Golden State Warriors. In Atlanta, presuming you guys are not, you know, sort of shockingly better than, say, Vegas or a lot of people think, you guys are in a place where you're more likely to win fewer games than you are to win 73, it does affect you. What is your view on sort of the new rules that are coming in they're in place, but they'll be in place the next draft, and just the idea of tanking in general?
Listen, I've been early in my days in Golden State, we were not good.
You're bad.
We were bad. Yeah. The year we drafted Harrison at 7, our first round pick was protected 1 through 7. And we made a decision halfway through that year to trade Monte Ellis, who was, you know, our best player at the time, for an injured Andrew Bogut, who we knew we wouldn't play. But, you know, we made that deal knowing two things. One, we'd never had a center in Golden State, a rim protector, when I was there anyway. So, you know, with eyes on the future, if we can get him healthy, get him back, we'd shut Steph down at the time. And we knew that we had to fall in those bottom 7 spots to get our pick, and that was really important to us. Tanking, I guess it was a conscious decision we made to shoot for next year. And it obviously worked out really well for us because we ended up getting Harrison, and then the following year we made it to second round versus the Spurs, and then got knocked out in the first round versus the Clippers, and then the following year we won a championship. So I think you have to, as a franchise, do what's best for the franchise, and sometimes that means, you know, securing your draft pick if you can. I think the problem with tanking, or the perception of tanking, is when teams go out there from day one and don't show any intention of winning. We're not doing that here in Atlanta. You know, I've maintained from day one that we're going to be competitive. It's important when you have a young team to have a winning environment. Players have to have the positive reinforcement of having success in this league.
Won your first game this year.
Won our first game. So when you look at the veterans that we added, now we weren't the first out of the gate and we didn't spend the most money, but we added high character veterans that are going to show up every night and work hard. So it's important to keep that culture and for these young guys to have the winning to reinforce all the hard work they're doing.
All right, one last one. I'm not trying to get you to comment on other teams, but I think it's an interesting example. People, the NBA, a lot of owners were really upset about Philly's approach, and just my own personal view, and we'll see, they are fun to watch. They are talented. I mean, they got a ways to go, but there is a lot of talent on that basketball team. From your perspective as a guy who has been on both sides of teams that are really bad and are maybe the greatest of all time, does it look like what happened in Philadelphia, by design or otherwise, is going to be successful?
Yeah, so, I mean, they're obviously, I mean, we don't have to pretend like it's not the elephant in the room. I'm like, that's the example that everyone's pointing to.
You know, right.
They went out there and they put guys on the floor who probably weren't, you know, NBA talent for 2 or 3 years. And they did it for the sole purpose to accumulate as many draft picks as they could by taking on contracts and to have as many opportunities in the draft as they could. they have a lot of really good young players. You know, if Embiid can stay healthy, which, you know, is a huge question mark
so
right
talented.
Now. He's
it's unbelievable.
He's a great player. Ben Simmons, obviously a great talent, great size, you know, has everything if he works on his jump shot. And, you know, Fultz is another young, talented kid. So they certainly have a bright future. You know, it was a long path for the fans of Philadelphia to get there.
It was.
But they seem to have a good future in front of them.
Travis Schlenk, really enjoyed the conversation. Very cool of you to make time. Congratulations on all your – it's good to see guys from the Midwest succeeding. We can do it too.
Exactly.
Thanks for the time.
No problem.